Presumably, it was McGann. But why would he do it? Well, maybe he was afraid that if Mueller were fired, it would implicate him in an obstruction of justice charge. Well, only McGann knows the answer. One thing is clear. The president also thought Sessions should be booted for not taking on the Russian investigation himself. Did McGann advise against this? And could the president be getting more and more irate at McGann and Sessions over Sessions' absurd recusal? There are several published reports that I went to the White House on November 1, 2017, to meet with the president about the lack of an investigation of the Clinton-Russia connection in the Uranium One deal. General Kelly and Don McGahn were the only people present in the Oval Office besides the president and me. During the meeting, I clearly voiced my views on Attorney General Sessions' lack of prosecutorial balls, as well as on Mueller's find-a-crime mission. The president was annoyed, but not with me, and left the room. The New York Times reported that General Kelly said I was not helping things, according to their leaker. I probably wasn't helping General Kelly keep order, and I clearly wasn't helping McGann. The president had showed his displeasure with McGann's namby-pamby approach to things. But who leaked this? When the New York Times called for a comment, I was shocked that anything from a closed-door meeting in the Oval Office with the President of the United States had made it to the New York Times. I called the President and General Kelly about the leak. Certainly, I didn't leak it, and the President didn't leak it. I trust General Kelly didn't leak it either. Don McGahn was the only other person there. A well-placed source tells me McGahn leaks information when he believes it suits his purposes. And people still wonder why Donald Trump must keep cleaning house. Nevertheless, General Kelly has helped smooth out the bumps every administration experiences in its first year, and once this one found its sea legs, it was full speed ahead. Making America Great Again. This is the Trump administration I've seen firsthand. It's quite different from the fictional one you've been told about by the 24/7 anti-Trump hate campaign. Let me tell you something. If one-tenth of the lies you've been told about the president, his family, and his administration were true, I wouldn't have been friends with Donald Trump for over 30 years. I wouldn't have put up with the boogeyman the media have created. Luckily, that boogeyman doesn't exist, least of all in the Oval Office. Just as egregious as all the distortions, mischaracterizations, and outright lies being published about Donald Trump are all the things not being published. Most Americans have no idea that less than 2 years after his inauguration, Donald Trump has accomplished more than most presidents accomplish in their entire presidencies. The media might as well be writing for Trump-hating Hollywood as accurately as they've reported what's really happened over the past year and a half. Out here in the real world, Americans are more prosperous, less likely to be unemployed, and live in a far safer world than they did on January 19, 2017. Yes, the media grudgingly reports when the Trump administration accomplishes something, putting a negative spin on that accomplishment whenever they can. But they bury the positive news, which is all true, under a mountain of negative coverage, which is mostly false. It's the equivalent of a hard copy newspaper putting an innocent man's indictment on page 1 and later reporting his acquittal on page 36 of one of their least read sections. So let me take a moment to tell you about the real Trump presidency, the one that is, as Donald Trump promised, making America great again. Since President Trump was elected, the economy has added 3 million jobs. In fact, today, there are more jobs available than there are unemployed. That's resulted in the lowest unemployment rate in 17 years. The stock market has roared to new highs despite the Federal Reserve raising interest rates 5 times since Trump's election. By the way, do you know how many times the Fed raised rates between Obama's election and Trump's? Once, after announcing they would set a course back to normalcy, having kept interest rates near zero for over 7 years, the Fed raised rates in December 2015 and the stock market plunged. They never attempted to raise them again until after Donald Trump won. Building a real economic recovery. That the market went up over 25% despite one rate hike after another shows the difference between the state of the economy under Trump versus Obama. President Obama was inaugurated just after a historic market crash and at the beginning of a deep recession. There was nowhere for the economy or the stock market to go but up. Yet, despite literally coming in at the bottom, Obama managed to hamper the economy badly enough to preside over the slowest, most anemic recovery in modern U.S. history. The economy needed monetary stimulus from the Fed under Obama. As soon as it was decreased ever so slightly, the market crashed. Since Trump has been in office, it has soared despite regular rate hikes. That's because President Trump has implemented policies that make this country hospitable to business again. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the largest tax cuts and reforms in U.S. history, lowered rates for American families and businesses. And guess what? Despite all the baloney about these merely being tax cuts for the rich, those cuts merely brought the United States in line with the world average. The United States' 39% corporate tax rate was the third highest in the world. Do you know what the corporate rate was in every lying liberal's paradise, Sweden? 22%. The Trump tax cuts merely brought our corporate tax rates in line with Sweden's. This tax reform bill wasn't just good for business. It will save the typical American family of four more than $2,000 in taxes each year by doubling the standard deduction, creating the child tax credit, and lowering individual rates for average income earners. And let's not forget the bill repealed the totalitarian Obamacare individual mandate. Speaking of the left's fascination with Scandinavia, I'd also like to point out another inconvenient truth the fake news never tells you about. Those countries may have larger welfare states, but they have much freer economies as far as regulation is concerned. While they do even better with less welfare, they are able to pay for it because their economies are not nearly as strangled as ours was under President Obama. On the campaign trail, Donald Trump promised to address this problem by instituting a rule for regulatory agencies to repeal 2 regulations for every 1 new regulation put in place. Well, the Trump administration didn't just keep that promise. They kept it more than tenfold, issuing 22 deregulatory actions for every 1 new regulatory action since January 2017. The president hasn't just taken executive action either. Unlike President Pen and Phone Obama, President Trump has worked with Congress, successfully getting resolutions passed to repeal 14 onerous Obama-era rules and regulations. Also, unlike his predecessors, President Trump isn't satisfied merely to see the stock market boom and corporate earnings improve, although both have occurred under his watch. This president promised American workers they'd have their fair share of the prosperity as well. Before his seat in the Oval Office was even warm, the president withdrew from the harmful Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, and began renegotiating NAFTA. Using the negotiating skills that made him a billionaire in the private sector, He secured new concessions in the Korea Free Trade Agreement, CORUS, K-O-R-U-S, that will benefit American automobile, pharmaceutical, steel, and agricultural producers. And he's taken a tough but respectful stance against China, fighting back against unfair Chinese trade practices and intellectual property theft. He announced $50 billion in new tariffs on Chinese goods and levied tariffs of 25% and 10% on Chinese steel and aluminum imports. Yet, all we hear from the media is Stormy Daniels and Mueller's never-ending search for non-existent collusion. We have important issues in this country, and we have important accomplishments by this president, said Kellyanne Conway. The 5 million Americans who received raises or bonuses, the millions more who live in communities that directly benefit from the jobs and opportunities created by the corporate tax cuts, all those people have a right to say they're tired of this. They want to know when it will end. Foreign policy miracles. One might be tempted to discount President Trump's stunning economic accomplishments because he's such a successful businessman. You'd expect economic policy to be his forte. But what he's been able to do with foreign policy in such a short time might even be more impressive. Remember ISIS? We don't hear much about them anymore, do we? That's because President Trump has accomplished in a matter of months what the Obama administration couldn't do in years. By simply working with allies and lifting unnecessary restrictions on America's military, ISIS has been effectively decimated. Nearly 100% of its territory has been liberated since President Trump took office. How often has the media congratulated his administration on this decisive victory? Crickets. Even worse, they've tried to spin one of his most stunning accomplishments into a negative. As of this writing, North and South Korea are engaged in peace talks after North Korea's dictator Kim Jong-un suspended the nuclear weapons testing that had threatened the stability in Asia for most of this century. President Trump's maximum pressure campaign against North Korea, excoriated by the media as reckless and dangerous, has brought the country to the negotiating table and secured one-sided concessions from North Korea. Amazingly, three American hostages have been returned. The comparison of the Trump presidency and the Obama presidency, as reflected in this one example, couldn't be more stark. It was during the Obama presidency that student Otto Warmbier was taken hostage, tortured to the point where he would never recover, and finally released under President Trump's watch. Unfortunately, it was too late for Mr. Warmbier. We watched in horror as he returned home and died shortly thereafter. President Trump also officially recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, fulfilling a promise other presidents failed to keep and strengthening ties with our closest ally in the Middle East. And for all those so-called allies who opposed the move at the UN, the president put them on notice that his administration would remember that when they later come with their hands out for aid. While maintaining his anti-regime change policy, President Trump has twice launched limited, targeted strikes against Syria's Assad regime for its illegal use of chemical weapons against its own citizens, letting Assad and the world know the United States will not stand by while international law is flouted in brutal fashion. As for Assad's ally Russia, the Trump administration has stood up to Russian aggression, announcing several sanctions packages against Russia and expelling Russian diplomats. An America First plan for Syria and the Middle East. The liberal left claims the recent airstrike on Syria's chemical production facilities was another one and done by a president who has no plan there. The conflict in Syria is based upon centuries-old religious differences going back even before the Crusades. As long as different religious views vie to steer a nation's politics, the battle within will never end. Trump knows this and has no intention of keeping the U.S. in Syria. However, Assad's second use of chemical weapons on his own people within a 12-month period was in violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention, CWC, which Syria acceded to in 2013 during the Obama administration under the not-so-watchful eye of Russia. Russia and Iran had long been attempting to meddle and spread their influence in Syria and throughout the region. There was widespread agreement that the threat of Iran in Syria was a clear and present danger to all concerned. When it became clear chemical weapons were again being manufactured and storage facilities built in Syria, President Trump made the decision to attack those facilities with the help of British and French forces. Since Iran's sworn mission is to destroy Israel, they intentionally kept Israel out of the strike. A clear message had been sent to Russia, Iran, and North Korea. If you violate international law, there will be consequences. The aftermath. Not one civilian was killed. Syria's chemical weapons manufacturing has been set back years, and North Korea announced it was shutting down its nuclear testing. President Trump has designated his trusted senior advisor, Jared Kushner, to work on bringing peace between the Israelis and Palestinians. Jared, along with Assistant to the President Jason Greenblatt, Ambassador David Friedman, and Jared's right hand, Special Assistant to the President Avram Berkowitz, began working on this difficult task. Berkowitz is a Harvard Law graduate who shares Jared's calm demeanor. He is particularly conversant with the situation in Israel, having spent 2 years in Israel before college studying at Yeshiva Kol Torah in Jerusalem. The team Jared headed visited the region and listened to important stakeholders. They worked methodically on a plan that is feasible given the current realities on the ground. In March 2018, Kushner hosted over 20 countries at a White House conference, including Israel, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Qatar. It was the first time in many years that both Israel and its Arab neighbors were in such a high-level meeting together. The Palestinian Authority chose not to attend. Nevertheless, Kushner's ability to assemble all those countries in the same room is in itself an important diplomatic achievement. The message the conference sent was that progress waits for no one. If the PLO wants to be part of the solution, great. If they are unwilling to help their fellow Palestinians, the Trump administration will move forward without them. The Palestinians must get on the bus or be isolated. Syria, North Korea, and Israel are just a few of President Trump's foreign policy accomplishments using his promised strategy of peace through strength. And while he secured the much-needed $700 billion in funding to rebuild the military, he has not recklessly plunged America into new conflicts as his predecessor did. He's also employed some tough love on our NATO allies to start paying more of their fair share of their own defense as required under the treaty. Using American power judiciously as leverage, he is on his way to brokering peace on the Korean Peninsula after almost 70 years of conflict, an honorable end to the war in Afghanistan, and a contained Iran. That's what you can achieve in world affairs when you put America first. Restoring America at Home. A booming economy and a more stable, peaceful world are wonderful accomplishments, but they are means, not ends. We don't become more productive merely to produce for its own sake, but to live more comfortable and enriching lives. And we don't fight wars and negotiate peace merely for its own sake, but so every American can live in the free society that is their birthright. Nothing we accomplish in the workplace or on the international stage means anything if it doesn't result in our being able to rebuild the America we deserve here at home. No one understands this more implicitly than Donald Trump. The very first building block of that America is the rule of law, which was under all-out assault from the left when Donald Trump assumed office. That's why President Trump is reshaping the judiciary and appointing conservative judges who will stand up for our constitutional rights, including Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, 14 Circuit Court judges, and 17 District Court judges. This doesn't mean simply ruling according to conservative preferences. Justice Gorsuch has already voted with the liberal justices on the Supreme Court on an immigration case because the Constitution called for that vote. While appointing justices like Gorsuch with the Second Amendment in mind, President Trump also recognizes the need for sensible regulation of the right to bear arms. He has issued an effective ban on bump stock sales and has signed into law critical pieces of legislation designed to better enforce existing gun laws, including the Fix-Nics Act, which strengthens federal background checks. As candidate Trump said many times on the campaign trail, you don't have a country without borders. Neither do you have the rule of law without effective enforcement of immigration laws. Republican and Democratic presidents have ignored the problem of illegal immigration for decades. The last president encouraged it, but there's a new sheriff in town. Working with states, President Trump is deploying the National Guard to the southern border to help ICE and Border Patrol agents. And let me remind you, he is taking this step because the swamp in Washington refuses to give him the tools he needs, including building the wall he promised the millions of voters who want to see it built. Nevertheless, President Trump did secure $1.6 billion in funding for 110 miles of physical barriers on the southern border, and the Department of Homeland Security has contracted and is testing border wall prototypes. Meanwhile, during the first 9 months of his administration, ICE made 110,568 arrests of illegal aliens, a 40% increase over the same period in 2016. And the president is working with agencies to fight the vicious criminal gang he calls animals, MS-13, leading to the arrest of more than 4,000 gang members last year. One of the most serious problems facing American families is the high cost of health care, which was exacerbated by President Obama's signature health care law. With the individual mandate eliminated by the tax reform bill, President Trump signed an executive order designed to offer greater choice, increase competition, and bring down health insurance costs by expanding association health plans, AHPs, short-term limited duration insurance plans, STLDI, and health reimbursement arrangements, HRAs. He also terminated Obamacare's unlawful cost-sharing reduction, CSR, payments that gave unauthorized money to health insurance companies. If the health care system was crippled and expensive for average American families, it was downright broken for our veterans. Fulfilling another campaign promise, President Trump signed legislation that offers new protections to VA whistleblowers and has allowed the VA to fire 1,298 failing employees as of this writing. He also ordered the development of a plan to provide transitioning veterans access to mental health care, achieving same-day mental health care at every single VA facility. In addition, the Trump administration launched a new 24-hour White House VA hotline to help veterans. The tragedy of heroin and other opioid overdoses is one more glaring problem politicians have paid lip service to and done nothing about. That's the swamp for you, always ready to grandstand, but never ready to deliver. President Trump declared the opioid crisis a nationwide public health emergency, released his initiative to stop opioid abuse and reduce drug supply and demand in March 2018, and is mobilizing his entire administration to address this problem and drug addiction in general. The omnibus funding bill signed by President Trump contains approximately $4 billion to combat the opioid crisis. The President's Bipartisan Push for Prison Reform. In 1993, I was elected district attorney in a county of approximately 1 million people. I was reelected and then reelected again. I ran an office of prosecutors where our daily fare was to deal on the battleground where the fight between good and evil unfolded every day. Our job was to settle scores for victims, the ones who never chose to be a part of the system in the first place. They didn't do anything, they didn't ask for it. Yet out of the blue, like a thunderbolt, criminals made the decision to turn their lives into a living nightmare. As prosecutors, we could not take away their pain or turn back the clock to undo the damage, but we could seek justice on their behalf. When I looked at the criminal justice system then, I didn't see many shades of gray. My philosophy was that it was the criminal who made the choice to commit a crime, and no amount of namby-pamby whining could excuse the wrongdoer. It didn't matter what the excuses were. Broken home, down on their luck, too drunk or high to know, or a rough childhood. There was so much focus on the defendant and their rights that I felt the system should be called the victim's justice system to support the victims rather than the criminals. As a county judge, my thought process was different. The purpose of my sentencing was fourfold. Deterrence, retribution, rehabilitation, incarceration. Today, many are convinced prison reform is necessary for the criminal justice system to work. They believe balancing overcrowding, costs, and recidivism should influence sentencing. As part of that, they also see a need to assess the risk of reentry into society. To me, the first duty of the criminal justice system is to obtain justice for the victim. Once that has been accomplished and the offender has been held accountable, then it's time to talk about prison reform. A 2013 RAND Corporation study concluded that inmates participating in educational programs exhibit a 43% lower recidivism rate than those who don't, and a 13% higher chance of employment. All these programs represent productive early steps in decreasing recidivism rates and thus helping address overcrowding in prisons and the high cost of incarceration, but they are only pilot programs that affect a small percentage of the prison population. Enter Donald J. Trump. The president campaigned on a platform of helping the forgotten men and women of this country, and many believe none are more forgotten than ex-convicts. Once a convict has served his sentence, the punishment should end. Prison overcrowding with nonviolent offenders allows violent criminals to be released earlier than they should be. That's a problem. And we must do whatever we can to see that a life of crime is not the only thing ex-convicts know, making it inevitable they'll be back to reoffend at the expense of new victims. The president believes that, and so do I. Jared Kushner agrees, and like me, has a special connection to this issue. His first priorities after the election were helping the president transition from successful businessman to successful president, the day-to-day operations of the White House, and helping promote the president's key priorities. But as the administration became established and key objectives were accomplished, Jared was able to devote some of his attention to prison reform. In September 2017, Jared held the first round of listening sessions on prison reform at the White House. He invited a bipartisan group to ensure diversity of ideas and opinions. The meetings were attended by senior officials at the state and federal levels, including cabinet secretaries, governors, and U.S. senators. Around this time, Jared decided to back the bipartisan First Step Act, a bill sponsored by Congressman Doug Collins and Hakeem Jeffries, to reduce crime by better preparing inmates for life outside of jail. By November 2017, momentum for Jared's initiative began to build. The president held a roundtable with governors, the attorney general, conservative activists, and faith leaders from around the country, following up with the bold statement, "We will be very tough on crime, but we will provide a ladder of opportunity for the future. We can help break this vicious cycle," the vicious cycle being high recidivism rates. A prison system that leaves former prisoners unprepared to join society helps neither former inmates who want to make a new start nor the rest of society who suffer the repeat offenses and pay for the repeat incarcerations. After the president's roundtable, Republican Governor Matt Bevin of Kentucky praised President Trump's efforts to USA Today, saying, "It takes someone to stop blowing smoke on it, which is what liberals have done for years. This has the ability to be something transformative, something like Nixon going to China and turning the world on its head." Jared continued to build a strong coalition of bipartisan support, and in January 2018, during his State of the Union address, President Trump gave the initiative strong support, saying, "As America regains its strength, this opportunity must be extended to all citizens. That is why this year we will embark on reforming our prisons to help former inmates who have served their time get a second chance." As Kellyanne Conway said, the president's policies are positioned to give equal opportunity for all. On March 7, 2018, the president signed an executive order creating a council to make recommendations on ways to reform prisons. The administration also publicly backed the First Step Act, which made it to the floor of the House for a vote on May 22, 2018. While the bill had bipartisan support, some Democrats opposed it. Jerry Nadler, a congressman from New York, made a plea on the House floor to Democrats and Republicans to vote against the bill. Despite that resistance, the bill passed the House overwhelmingly by a vote of 360-59. Senate Democrats are already signaling they will try to obstruct the bill. They don't want President Trump succeeding at anything, no matter how much it might benefit the Americans they represent. They certainly don't want him succeeding where they failed to help a population disproportionately composed of people of color. There are some who oppose the bill because it doesn't go far enough. Senator Lindsey Graham wants reduced mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent offenders included. The ACLU and the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund are concerned that a narrow first-step approach would delay sentencing, understaffing, confinement, and other concerns. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican Iowa, chair of the Judiciary Committee and Senate leader on criminal justice reform, recognizes the need for prison reform, but is concerned that the First Step Act will not pass without sentencing reform, which does not yet have enough bipartisan support in the Senate. Some of the Republican hesitance in the Senate may be due to Attorney General Jeff Sessions' strong criminal justice position, which emphasizes the punitive approach. I agree with that for violent criminals, but Sessions doesn't seem to consider the total cost to society of recidivism, including monetary costs to taxpayers, the social costs of the repeat offenses, and the opportunity costs of all those services better prepared former inmates may have contributed to society through gainful employment. Whatever their reasons, it's time for Republicans to stop dragging their heels on this and not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. I'm not saying sentencing reform isn't needed, but this bill will start chopping away at the overall problem immediately. Pass the First Step Act and then continue the debates on sentencing reform. Are you listening, Mitch McConnell? You have a chance to do something that will help your country and your party in this November's midterm elections. Yes, it will also reflect positively on the president, but you'll just have to put your rhino instincts aside for a change. Order this bill to the floor of the Senate for a vote. Even Kim Kardashian has done more than Rhino Mitch to move this bill forward. She visited the White House and met with the president and Jared Kushner to discuss ways she could get involved in the prison reform effort. Kardashian instantly brought a national spotlight to this important issue and helped put pressure on the Senate to bring the bill to the Senate floor. The implementation of risk assessments could help overcome resistance to this bill. A risk assessment collects information on behavior and attitudes associated with lower rates of recidivism. This is generally known as the Risk Needs Responsivity RNR model. The concept is often criticized for being correlated with race and therefore discriminatory. If assessments are discriminatory, fix them. But they should be used extensively throughout the criminal justice system, from pretrial detention through release considerations. Not only will the success rates be higher, but those with legitimate concerns about this approach will know we aren't just releasing anyone and everyone to cut costs and address overcrowding in prisons. The president has led on this issue. His administration has reached across the aisle to get a bill through the House and into the Senate's hands. It's time for senators in both houses to stop playing politics and for Mitch McConnell to bring this forward for an up or down vote. Rebuilding America First. One issue that should be bipartisan even in today's polarized political environment is national infrastructure. The United States is the richest, most powerful country in the world, but its roads, bridges, airports, and other infrastructure often look more like a third world country's. And with the enormous debt his predecessor ran up, rebuilding our country might seem like a very uphill battle. It probably would be for most politicians, but not for a billionaire real estate developer. Drawing on the distinctively American history of private infrastructure development, President Trump has outlined a plan to rebuild America's infrastructure with $200 billion in federal funds that would spur at least $1.5 trillion in private investments across America. To streamline the federal permitting process for infrastructure projects, federal agencies have signed the One Federal Decision Memorandum of Understanding, MOU. The president will make getting his plan through Congress a key part of the second half of his first term. The president removed a major obstacle to energy independence and new jobs by approving the Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines, expediting pipeline approval and production, and improving the permitting and approval processes for liquefied natural gas, LNG, terminals, and exports. He also ended the Obama administration's war on coal, rolling back harmful regulations and policies, including the Clean Power Plan and Stream Protection Rule. Empowering women in America. When the so-called Women's March descended on Washington, D.C. on January 21, 2017, I was out on the street with a microphone. I'd been interviewing people since early in the morning, hoping to get a few quotes for the Street Justice segment that runs at the end of my show. I'd brought along two Navy SEALs just in case. I really did. Wherever I went, the SEALs stood on either side of me. My camera crew, as usual, was in front, getting it all on film. For the most part, the interviews went fine. I got to argue with a few people with whom I didn't exactly see eye to eye, and then tried my best to learn what the heck this movement for all women was about. Not much, as it turned out. There were some women who believed the march had been organized to impeach Donald Trump. Others thought it was one big abortion rally. One woman told me she didn't care what happened as long as the Democrats took the midterm elections. At some point, after we'd been out for a few hours, the feeling in the streets shifted. The crowd was getting bigger and the signs were getting angrier. I've been in protests that turned to riots back in the 70s when I was in Europe. I knew when a crowd was starting to become hostile. I moved a little closer to my SEAL friends, hoping we could get out fast. Before long, people were hurling insults my way. They called me and my crew names I don't care to repeat, and I'm not exactly a shrinking violet. A mob mentality had taken charge for certain. It was as if their human brain shut down and something primitive took over when they saw the Fox News logo on my microphone. By that afternoon, every fake news station in the country had fawning coverage of the marches, making them seem like peaceful little knitting circles rather than open rebellions against our newly elected president. I was on the streets. I knew different. I saw the march for what it was. These people were militant. They were marching for women, all right. Just not the ones who believe human life is sacred and begins at conception. Not the ones who want a strong military, and certainly not the ones who think illegal immigration is out of hand. In other words, not for any of the millions of women who had cast their votes for Donald Trump a couple of months before. Yet they had the audacity to tell the world that they spoke for all women. It wasn't until I got home that the irony of it all dawned on me. If you had told me when I was a little girl that I would become a prosecutor, a judge, and one of the first female district attorneys in the state of New York, and then the host of a television show, only to be spit at and ridiculed during a march for all women, I'm not sure I would have believed you. In those days, the goal was equality of opportunity. It was making sure everyone had a fair shot. The women who raised me and the women I grew up with only wanted the same opportunities and the same rights as their male counterparts. They weren't easy to get, but they fought hard, and my generation carried the same torch. Before I was the DA of Westchester, I was an assistant DA. It was during that time that I started one of the first domestic violence units in the country. To do that, I had to convince the police chiefs from 43 municipalities in Westchester County, all men, to allow us to work with their departments. Back then, many of them didn't think domestic violence cases even belonged in the criminal justice system. They felt they were social problems, not criminal justice problems. The DA scheduled a breakfast meeting so I could lecture on the legal requirements of the domestic violence legislation to a room full of hardened armed cops. Just when I was about to begin, one of the chiefs said to me, "Hun, before we start, can you grab me a cup of coffee?" Inside, I was burning. I wanted to grab him by the throat, but an angel on my right shoulder calmed me. "Janine," it said, "you've got a mission, and this meeting is not about this SOB. It's about victims." "Cream and sugar?" I asked, just as sweet as can be. Then I sat down and told them what we expected and what we wanted them to do. We got their cooperation, and my unit became a national model for the prosecution of batterers and set records for convictions. When I marched in the middle of the protesters in Washington with a cameraman in tow, I asked what they were protesting. Between curse words, they said they want equal rights for women. I asked what rights they were fighting for. None of them could come up with a straight answer. What right does a man have that you don't, I asked? Just name one. My questions were met with nothing but stammering and blank stares. All along, they'd been pretending they were marching for something when their march was nothing more than a hissy fit, thrown because someone they didn't like managed to win an election. All they knew about Donald Trump is what the fake press fed them, so they didn't know him at all. Since he was a real estate developer in Manhattan, the president has promoted the causes of women and also promoted women. In the 1980s, at a time when very few women were working in construction and development, Trump had several female development and construction project managers, while other women, if they were in the industry at all, were working in sales and marketing. He created opportunities for women in the male-dominated construction industry long before it was fashionable or socially responsible to do so. In the Trump Organization, a woman who started as a secretary or a low-level office worker could have a reasonable expectation of rising through the company's ranks within a few years. All it took was hard work and a few good ideas. In fact, it was a woman who handled much of Donald Trump's day-to-day business when he had too much to do. Norma Foderer, one of Trump's most trusted employees, started with the Trump Organization in 1981 when it was only 7 or 8 people in a room and ascended the corporate ladder all the way to the boss's right-hand side. During the campaign, a former representative for Donald Trump told the Washington Post that Foderer would advise Trump on everything, from what color tie to wear to whether or not he should purchase a building. When Foderer died from a heart attack during surgery in 2013, Donald was devastated. He hired Deidre Rosen as the VP of Human Resources, Jill Martin as Assistant General Counsel, Louise Sunshine as an Executive Vice President, and Amanda Miller as Head of Marketing. And of course, there's Rona Graff, his treasured, longtime personal assistant. Today, according to company representatives, there are far more women than men working in the Trump Organization. That's better than most Fortune 500 companies. It's certainly better than most of the law firms I've dealt with, and it's not the kind of thing that happens overnight. In business, Donald Trump cared about the advancement of women long before there were hashtags and half-assed marches to bring the issue into the public eye. In the years when I, as a young prosecutor, was fighting to convince judges and juries that a man didn't have the legal right to beat his wife, women at the Trump Organization were able to lead fulfilling lives at home and in the office. Equal opportunity is bred into the culture of the Trump Org, and it comes straight from the top. For the past decade, the Trump Organization's largest deals were spearheaded by another woman, his daughter Ivanka Trump, who oversaw the acquisition and development of their largest projects. Trump had a famous line in the 80s, which I always found a little funny. Someone had asked him whether men were better than women in business. "Men are better than women," he said, going along with the joke, "but a good woman is better than 10 good men." His daughter Ivanka fits this bill. Nowhere does President Trump show more respect for women than in his relationship with his daughter, while no one is treated with more hypocrisy by the press. Let me give you an example. In March 2015, less than 3 months before her father announced he would run for president, Vogue published a flattering feature in their magazine Power issue on Ivanka subtitled, "Full Speed at Work and Hands On at Home." Ivanka Trump knows what it means to be a modern millennial, the exact demographic she wants to dress. Almost immediately after her father announced, the same magazine began to publish one negative article after another about her. Where Ivanka was the poster girl for millennials before the campaign, she was a faux feminist after. Where she had been an entrepreneur before he announced, she was an opportunist after. Previously described as true to herself, once her father announced his presidency, the media claimed her views were hypocritical bullshit. I'll tell you what's bullshit. Anything Vogue has written about Ivanka since June 16, 2015. I've known Ivanka since she was a teenager, before she got her degree at Wharton or joined the Trump Organization, and long before she had to deal with the press. Even when she was a kid, you could tell she'd be better than a few hundred good men. When Ivanka joined her father's business in 2006 at the age of 24, she proved her competence every day. She'd already worked 2 years at an outside firm to learn the ropes of real estate, not wanting to seem as if she was taking handouts from her father, and had learned a few things of her own. Within just a few years, she worked with her brothers to oversee the expansion of the core real estate business and co-found her own branch of the business, a successful management company for luxury hotels called the Trump Hotel Collection. By the time she was a co-judge on Celebrity Apprentice, the press had fallen head over heels in love with her. She was everything a successful woman should be, they said at the time. Fortune magazine named her one of its 40 under 40, the magazine's famous list of the most influential young people in the business world. She helped found the Girl Up Initiative at the United Nations Foundation, which provides adolescent women and girls in the developing world with opportunities to succeed and thrive as leaders in their communities. She was described at the National Women's Summit as a woman with a drive to support other women. She won the Diamond Empowerment Fund's Good Award for helping promote education in diamond-producing African nations. In business, she received the prestigious Joseph Wharton Award for Young Leadership from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and was given the Young Global Leader Award from the World Economic Forum, the ACE Breakthrough Award for Excellence in Accessories, and the FABB Achievement Award from the Fashion Accessories Council for her innovative brand. Ironically, the left most shows its bias and hypocrisy in its treatment of women, well, certain women. While they saw Hillary Clinton as an independent woman and not held responsible for the actions of her husband, Bill, Ivanka Trump was ostracized for being Donald Trump's daughter. Recently, in a Vogue article about fashion designer Georgina Chapman, the magazine says that she shouldn't be judged by her monster husband, Harvey Weinstein. But if you're a conservative or a Trump, the rules are different. In February 2017, 1 month after Donald Trump took office, a female Nordstrom executive proudly trumpeted that Nordstrom's would be dropping Ivanka Trump's fashion line. The genesis of this was an online campaign started by a marketer, Shannon Coulter, no relation to Anne, who didn't much like the president. So she decided to take it out on his daughter, creating the hashtag #GrabYourWallet. Her campaign sought to punish the Ivanka Trump brand for the supposed misdeeds of Ivanka's father. It was clear this was a political hit job because Ivanka's brand revenue went up 21% from 2015 to 2016. 6 months before Donald Trump announced his candidacy for president, Ivanka was invited to open Nordstrom's new flagship department store in Vancouver, where she appeared alongside the Nordstrom family and Anna Wintour of Vogue. If the brand had not been selling well in Nordstrom's, they wouldn't have ordered more products for the spring 2017 season. Ironically, Ivanka is not political. Ivanka clearly cares about policy, just not swamp politics. she admitted as much at the Republican convention, saying that she was neither Republican nor Democrat. She became involved in the campaign with the intention of talking about women and their advancement, including what her father taught her, how he advanced women in his company, and what he would do to empower women in the American workplace. This has been proven to be true now that we see the lowest female unemployment rate in 18 years. After her father became president, she left the family business she'd been groomed to run from the time she was a little girl. Yes, a woman groomed to run what most see as a male-dominated business by the very man these hashtagging women despise. She left to continue to advocate for women in the workforce. She left her own business and its talented team of women, leaving her home and a comfortable life for the Washington Shark Tank. Ivanka continues forging ahead in her decade-long effort to empower women in the workplace. So to all the hashtag haters and classless women, as well as the stores that capitulate to them, I have news for you. She is stronger than you and amazingly is every bit as strong as her dad. The very so-called feminists who marched to advance strong, independent women are the ones rallying to suppress a woman who epitomizes everything these women claim to champion. I challenge them to explain their blatant hypocrisy, asking Ivanka to answer for her dad when Chelsea Clinton never has to. Chelsea is currently making the rounds for her book, She Persisted. Is anyone asking her about her father's many accusers, one of whom accused him of rape, as well as his consensual sex in the Oval with an intern while in office? I don't think so. I challenge them to tell you why Melania Trump, one of the most beautiful women in the world, has been on the cover of only one women's national magazine, while Michelle Obama and Hillary Clinton were featured extensively. Recently, one early spring Sunday, I visited Ivanka and Jared in their beautiful home in the Kalorama section of Washington. I was met at the door by Ivanka and Jared's 4-year-old son, Joseph, who extended his hand to greet me and introduced himself. I smiled, thinking, what an adorable and proper young man. Then he stunned me with a question in perfect diction. May I get you a drink? I turned and looked at the Secret Service agent behind me. He nodded to me as if to say yes. I turned back, looked at Joseph and said, yes, thank you. To which he inquired, would you like a Shirley Temple? I burst out laughing and thanked him. Ivanka was dressed in a 2-piece white knit outfit and looking casual yet stunning. Together, we walked into a lovely dining room with a table set for lunch. Large windows looked out on a small backyard filled with bikes, toys, and a child's jungle gym. The yard was a feature that helped sway Ivanka and Jared to take the house, she said. Having lived in Manhattan, backyards are a luxury. Jared walked into the dining room dressed in dark slacks and light-colored casual shirt. The thing that strikes you first about him is how handsome he is in person, tall, trim, with an easy smile and piercing eyes. When you see Jared and Ivanka together, you realize how perfect they are for each other. Theirs is a respectful, loving marriage. It's obvious. As we sat at the table, their 6-year-old daughter, Arabella, appeared from the living room. Precocious, with her mother's eyes and a smile like her dad's, she showed us the latest dance moves she'd learned and recited poetry of Confucius. A born entertainer, Arabella's singing videos have already gone viral. One of them is a song she sang in Mandarin with her brother Joseph at Mar-a-Lago for Chinese President Xi. The children learned Mandarin from a Chinese nanny. The video has had millions of views in China alone. Ivanka reminded Arabella to introduce herself, which she did with a ladylike bow. Then Joseph, who's a biological stamp of his father, came back in wearing his bicycle helmet, looking ready to hit the trail. Theodore, the baby, is still a little young for banter with adults. Ivanka was pregnant with him during the campaign. Right after he was born, his grandfather went on a winning streak across America, so Ivanka called Theodore their good luck charm. As a spring sun poured through the windows, we